On the program today, big oil gets a little bit smaller. So too does the labor force. But hey, not a word about Greece today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 2nd of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The dateline on our lead story today is New Orleans, Louisiana. The timestamp could well be April 20th, 2010. The Deepwater Horizon oil rig explodes that day. 11 people are killed, and crude oil flows into the Gulf of Mexico for the next 3 months. Today, BP agreed to pay a record $18.7 billion to settle state and federal claims against it. In all, that makes the company's liability more than $40 billion, once you count cleanup and compensation and all the rest. Marketplace's Scott Tong has been following the story. He is on the line. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so here we are, $40 billion, more than $40 billion later.
Yep.
Is big oil doing what it does any differently than it did, you know, 5 years ago?
In a lot of ways, Kai, it is. For one, the rules have changed. There are a lot more audits of safety protocols than existed before. There's now a federal agency that exclusively focuses on offshore oil safety, and that didn't exist before. And then when you look at industry, a lot of the practices have changed. You'll recall BP struggled to cap that well for 87 days.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now every single driller has to have containment equipment on the ready to go immediately. That didn't exist before. There's also 24/7 monitoring of these offshore rigs onshore. So a lot of this is about managing risk and putting in redundancies, and there are several more layers that exist today than before the spill.
All right, what about financial risk then for BP, the corporate story here, right? Because even for a company that was as big as BP was, more than $40 billion, it wasn't as a whole lot of money.
It's a staggering amount of money, even for a giant company. I spoke today with Michigan law professor David Ullman, who says, you know, this amount of money sends a message that the major oil companies, they have no choice but to change.
BP has paid out approximately $50 billion, a sum of money that only a very few companies could afford. There is no way for the drilling industry to conduct operations the way BP was before the Gulf oil spill.
And Kai, as you know, BP is now a much smaller company than it once was. And periodically, the question comes up, is BP a takeover target? So it's certainly changed for the company.
Okay, so here's the counterfactual then. If BP has changed, or I guess it's a counterfactual, I don't know. If BP has changed, and if safety protocols and regulation have changed, what has not?
The question is whether culture has changed. I spoke to a lot of people in industry today. And they say BP safety culture was not the best in the industry. ExxonMobil is considered the gold standard. And so there's the question of BP culture. And industry-wide, the broader question of, can this happen to us? You know, several people in industry said there's still a lot of people out there who say this could never happen to us. Even though, as geologists will say, as good as your management is above ground, as they put it, there are so many uncertainties below ground. And how much do you appreciate that uncertainty?
Mm-hmm. The unknown unknowns, I guess,
yep.
To quote an entirely different thing. Scott Tong from our Washington Bureau. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks.
It is a rare jobs day indeed where that is not our lead story. But about that, two things to say. Number one, today's unemployment report came to us a day early thanks to the holiday weekend, so we're out of sorts to begin with. Also, number two, the numbers themselves are extremely meh. The economy added a couple of 100,000 jobs in June, 223,000 if you're counting, and the unemployment rate dropped slightly to 5.3%, which was all of it less good than anybody was expecting. As often happens, though, the devil is in the details with the unemployment report, specifically something called the labor force participation rate, the share of working age people who have a job or are looking for one. That participation rate has dropped to its lowest level since the late 1970s, which is either A, worrisome, or B, completely to be expected. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson tells us which.
If you're a teen looking for a summer job, things maybe got a little better than last year. But for those of us who are quote-unquote prime age, that's 25 to 54, deep breath, dramatic pause. The Economic Policy Institute's Elise Gould says there are a lot of missing workers.
So potential workers who, because of weak job opportunities, are neither employed nor actively seeking a job.
Over two-thirds of those missing workers are prime age.
It's just a sign that the economy is not that strong, and they don't see a place for themselves in it right now.
And for baby boomers, we know they're working longer than before, but not enough to make up for those who are now retiring, says Gary Burtless at the Brookings Institution.
The fact that at age 65, more and more people are participants and more of them are employed, well, that might be a surprise, but nonetheless, it's a small offset.
Moving from age to gender, men left the workforce in June in big numbers, continuing a multi-decade trend. But after steady increases in the 90s for women, their participation rates have also fallen in recent years, says John Sylvia, the chief economist at Wells Fargo.
Maybe that oftentimes the female is the second breadwinner, and the cost of her going to work, taking care of the kids, the marginal tax rates just don't provide the incentives for the second breadwinner, whether male or female, to go out there and get the job.
In other words, the size of the American workforce, it's facing some headwinds, both economic and demographic. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders tried, they really did, but they just couldn't drag the indices back into the green. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just a couple of years ago, there were four black-owned banks in Chicago. Today, there are two, and regulators have told one of them, Illinois Service Federal Savings and Loan, that they're going to shut it down if it doesn't increase its capital reserves, have more money on hand. The decline is part of a national trend because, unlike the more segregated days when those banks were founded, African-American customers can take their business elsewhere now if they so choose. But as Dan Weissman reports, black-owned banks provide a link to history, and research says they may do something a lot more important, too.
Okay, let's go back in time.
Carter Hines and his great band, playing for you from the new Grand Terrace on Chicago's Great South Side.
At its height, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, the South Side's Bronzeville neighborhood was Chicago's version of Harlem.
Bronzeville used to be known as Black Metropolis.
That's Clifford Rome. We're sitting at a table in his new restaurant, Peaches, across the street from Illinois Service.
So you had all these pioneers who built their businesses on the south side of Chicago, man. So you can go to a butcher, baker, candlestick maker, right? You know, you had these great banks and you had all these entertainers.
Earl Hines started playing in Bronzeville with Louis Armstrong in the 1920s and spent the 30s playing national broadcasts from 39th Street.
So having all that meant that you didn't have to go anywhere else.
And you pretty much couldn't. Segregation was in full force, and white-owned banks did not cross the color line to make loans. That's where Illinois Service Federal comes in.
We were started in 1934 by 13 African-American men with $7,000.
That's Norman Williams, the bank's CEO. One of those 13 founders was his father.
Its mission was simply to provide home loans and help people open savings accounts.
Today, the bank still has deeply loyal customers like Cliff Rome. He runs a catering business, an art gallery, and another restaurant on King Drive. And at Peaches, he tells me he's kept multiple accounts with Illinois Service for years.
Once I walked in the doors, I realized, this is kind of like a throwback. Right?
The bank's current headquarters looked ultra modern when it went up almost 50 years ago.
But it has this unique quality. It feels community.
He says he banks with Illinois Service for the same reason he uses the dry cleaner next door and the bakery down the street, to support neighborhood institutions.
You need a community bank. You do. Even if that community bank doesn't have the bandwidth to do all the things that larger banks do, it's here.
However, the financial crisis and the recession hit banks like Illinois Service especially hard. African Americans, like Norman Williams' borrowers, were more likely than others to lose their jobs and miss mortgage payments.
People didn't abandon their home. They just got behind. Good, decent people, but...
Thanks in part to new banking regulations, their problems became Illinois Service's problems. And that's why regulators have the bank in their sights. John Taylor runs the Community Reinvestment Coalition. He sees community banks like Illinois Service disappearing all over the country.
And that's really the challenge, because disappearing with them is the personal commitment of boards of directors to make sure that those communities, those neighborhoods prosper.
Taylor believes the issue here is not losing black banks, but losing community banks.
The local is more key than the race of the bank president.
But research shows that race plays a role too. For a study published last year in a journal from Oxford University Press, a team of researchers from Rutgers, Brigham Young, and Utah State sent mystery shoppers into around 80 banks. They posed as small business owners looking for a loan. They all had the same story and the same outfit, but some were black, some were white, and some were Latino.
Well, we found significant differences.
That's Jerome Williams from Rutgers. The study found bank officers asked tougher questions of minority applicants, like they wanted to see more years of financial records. The mystery shoppers also used hidden cameras, and everybody who saw the tapes agreed bank officers were just nicer to white applicants.
There was a lot of bantering and interaction and jokes, being very, very friendly.
With the black and Latino mystery shoppers, not so much. It led to a simple conclusion. For black and Latino entrepreneurs looking for a bank loan,
the playing field is not level, so there's already a mark against you in terms of your background and applying for the loan.
In that context, banks like Illinois Service seem even more important. CEO Norman Williams says he's looking for community-minded investors. He thinks he'll make it.
But it's certainly something that does keep me up at night because I do think how much good we could do, how much work needs to be done on the south side of Chicago.
Right now, he needs about $7 million in new capital to keep Illinois Service doing that work. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up, for some reason he neglected economics to his grief and actually to the grief of all of us because the stupidest thing he did was wage and price controls, which had a real cost.
Richard Nixon and his economic legacy. Yes, he does have one. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks and bonds are closed tomorrow, everybody. It is the 4th of July observed, as it were. So a down week ends with a meh kind of day on Wall Street. I guess that's a word of the day today, meh. The Dow Industrials gave back 27 points, a 10th percent, closed at 17,730. The NASDAQ lost 3 points, less than a 10th percent, 5,009. The S&P 500 off a fraction of a point, pretty much even, 2,076. For the week, the Dow and the S&P both shed about 1.2%. The NASDAQ was down 1.4%. Investors seemed to cheer the BP settlement we told you about. Shares, U.S. shares, rather, in the oil giant, up 4.3%. News from the business of moving money around the world. PayPal is going to buy the digital money transfer company Zoom for $890 million. Zoom shares shot up 21% on that news. PayPal, you might remember, is about to be spun off from eBay. Shares in eBay up 2.3% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.38%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Independence Day is observed on Wall Street. Markets are closed. Back to the Future was released in theaters July 3rd, 1985. The future was 30 years ago. And we enter the dog days of summer, typically the hottest days of the year. It's a good thing July is National Ice Cream Month. Just what the doctor ordered, right? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We direct your attention now to Securities and Exchange Commission Form S-1. It's officially titled a registration statement under the Securities Act of 1933. It was filed today by Univision. The country's biggest Spanish-language broadcaster is going public. No word yet on how many shares it's going to offer or how much it hopes to raise in its IPO. But as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, going public now makes some sense for Univision.
It's a good time to be Univision Holdings. It's often beating the big networks during prime time among the coveted 18 to 34-year-old demographic. It's got local television stations at the top of their market. Alex Nogales is the CEO of the National Hispanic Media Coalition.
Their numbers are up. Their advertising rates are up. They're just doing a great job with the Latino community.
And the Latino community is a community that advertisers want.
they're in the, I'm going to say, the perfect demographic.
Carl Salas is an analyst at Moody's. He says it's a demographic that's growing, that's young, and
the consumer spending represented by Hispanics, that's only increasing over time.
By some estimates, the spending power of the Hispanic community in the U.S. is around $1.5 trillion. Angeline Close-Scheinbaum is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. She says Donald Trump, turns out he's an important part of this story. The decision by Univision to sever ties with him after he insulted Mexican immigrants.
From a consumer psychology lens, I think this couldn't have been better.
Univision showed potential investors what it is.
I wouldn't do a buy-in to an IPO unless I believed in the company, not only their product or service, but in this case, their values.
It's the sort of brand awareness that'd be tough to buy. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Science fairs these days are most definitely not like they used to be. Forget the baking soda volcanoes and all that. These days, it's more about better tests for cancer or improving air quality on planes. And really, why stop there? Why not get a patent and some venture backers, too? The Army is trying to help budding inventors do just that, as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR.
Come on in. 3D printing one.
In a hotel in suburban Baltimore, kids file into a conference room wearing Army-issued white lab coats and safety goggles.
All right, guys, go ahead and grab a seat anywhere. Yep.
These middle schoolers are finalists in the U.S. Army's annual e-cyber mission STEM Fair. 20 teams selected from more than 7,000 around the country for their problem-solving projects. Before the big competition, they break into small groups for some training.
We're actually going to have you guys do some inventing. So we're going to give you some clay.
Instructor Ralph Tillinghast passes out packs of colored clay and some tools and asks the kids to design a product to make their daily lives better. 12-year-old Caleb Ruthart gets to work sculpting a tiny robot.
At our school, we aren't allowed to carry around backpacks, so we have to carry about 5 or 6 binders. So my idea is to make a binder carrier, like a robot, kind of.
Caleb is from a small town in West Texas, near Lubbock.
Why aren't you allowed to carry backpacks?
Well, the teachers have tripped on the backpacks before, because our classrooms are kind of small.
Do you think teachers might trip over a robot?
Well, maybe we could leave it outside. I don't know.
He's still working it out. And that's part of the innovation process. The workshop is designed to teach kids how to take an idea, test it, patent it, and bring it to market. Yes, these are 12 and 13-year-olds.
There's no royalties to the Army. It's really to help them, just inspire them to know that they can take their idea and bring it to the world.
Tillinghast directs the Collaboration Innovation Lab at the U.S. Army's Armament Research, Development, and Engineering Center, where the guns and bullets are designed. He says the Army has a big stake in inspiring the next generation of innovators.
We can only hire U.S. citizens, so we need a pool in America of students who are competent in STEM areas.
To inspire those students, Tillinghast shows them how to make a prototype using a 3D printer and how to write a pitch sheet. Shri Chander's son, Rashil, is part of a team that developed an app to help first responders communicate in emergencies. She says it's no wonder kids are motivated by the idea of commercial success.
I think it's all around them. What they are watching on the news is, oh, here's a 12-year-old who showed up at the Apple Developer Conference because his app was rated number one in the App Store.
Chander herself is a scientist who now works on projects like the internet-connected car at AT&T.
Pure science is sometimes so abstract that it's hard for 12, 13-year-olds to kind of visualize it in their head. Whereas these things, which is apps, products, you know, something that you can touch, feel, play around with, that I think to them is more concrete.
Several of the teams are already on their way to marketing their ideas. DuPont and 3M have expressed interest in a more comfortable hazmat suit one team developed. Another team is working to patent its device to prevent drowsy driving. Caleb Ruthart's group from West Texas designed a system for reclaiming wastewater from the fracking process. A Texas business has asked to check it out. Team member Dwayne Scott seems almost embarrassed by the idea of making money on the project.
Feels amazing, but we're doing this mostly for the environment.
And his mom says for the thrill of making it to the finals. They ended up beating out the hazmat suit to take home the top sixth grade prize, $5,000 in savings bonds for each kid on the team. In Hunt Valley, Maryland, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Nobody includes Richard Nixon on their list of this country's best presidents. But that doesn't mean Nixon hasn't had some lasting impacts politically, of course, economically, though, too. Author Evan Thomas has a new book out about the 37th president. It's called Being Nixon. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here, Kai.
Why pursue yet another biography of Richard Nixon?
Nixon's become kind of a cartoon to us. We think he's wicked and evil. I just didn't believe that, even though I worked for the Washington Post Company for 24 years, which had a lot to do with his disappearing from office. I just thought there had to be a more interesting person here, and there is.
What's the most interesting thing, then?
He wanted to be a good person. Late at night, he would take his yellow pad, his aides called his yellow pad, his best friend, because he liked being alone with his yellow pad. And he would write notes to himself about who he wanted to be. He wanted to be gentle and joyful and considerate. All these things he was not, or he was not on a regular basis. Yeah. But he wanted to be that person. And it showed. He was a patriot. He wanted to serve his country. He really did. He accomplished an amazing amount as president. Some of it was bad, like wage and price controls, but some of it was good, like opening up China and arms control of the Soviet Union. He did a lot.
So let's jump into some of those things that he did. Were he to come back and walk the earth today, would he recognize our relationship with China and what China has become in the global economy? Because he was the guy. Nixon goes to China, right?
No, I think he would see it as a vindication of his belief that China could join the world. And after all, China's our great trading partner. That part he would have liked. He also would have been a realist about China's lust for power.
Yeah.
But I think he would have thought that he did the right thing. Maybe that's self-justifying, but he would have believed that.
Richard Nixon, you write, was, and this is a quote, he was a substantive, unusually well-read political leader. His economic expertise was surprisingly shallow.
Nixon was an intellectual. He really was. He read deeply and widely, but mostly about international affairs. For some reason, he neglected economics to his grief and actually to the grief of all of us, because the stupidest thing he did was wage and price controls, which had a real cost.
Wage and price controls. 1971, the gold standard comes and he wants to get us off it. It's a long, complicated story, which I will let you summarize here in 30 seconds, because you'll do a better job than I will.
Well, we were afraid if we went off the gold standard, there'd be inflation. Really, what they should have done is raise interest rates some. But Nixon wasn't...
No president's ever going
to
do that.
Right, because he wanted to get reelected. Right. So he was darned. He remembered in 1960 that Eisenhower put us through a little recession, and Nixon felt that cost him the 60 election. He was not going to make that mistake again. So no higher interest rates. Instead, he takes a tool from the Democratic toolbox, wage and price controls, because he had this whole thing. He loved confounding his enemies.
Yeah.
And it's kind of clever, and it worked for a little while. You know, it was very popular in its time, but of course it was ultimately a terrible idea with very bad long-term implications.
There's a great scene where he takes the whole cabinet to Camp David to hash over this new economic policy, he calls it. Included in that group, and this blew my mind, was Arthur Burns, the chairman of the Fed. And you'd no sooner see Janet Yellen now going to Camp David with a little kumbaya with the cabinet than anything.
He bullies the head of the Fed. Who stands up to him a little bit, but not much. Getting everybody up on Camp David was his way of saying, you're in my place, you're going to do what I say. Here's the program, folks. Yeah. Get with it.
When you
sit down and think about Richard Nixon on balance, all in, good or bad?
He deserved to be driven from office. He did. He busted the Constitution. He disgraced his office. That's a terrible thing, and history will never forgive him for that. But he did some great things. He really did some great things. He was an activist. Washington is barely functional today. Nothing happens. Look at what Richard Nixon did. EPA, OSHA, expanding Social Security benefits for the disabled.
Clean Air Act. Wasn't that him too? Right?
Clean Air Act. Yeah. All of that stuff. Now, Petty Nixon refused to invite Edmund Muskie, the sponsor of it, to the signing ceremony. But look, he did all these things. He was an activist. He was clever, Machiavellian about it. But as somebody reminded me yesterday, Machiavelli wanted to be a good prince. Huh. Nixon wanted to be a good prince. He wasn't always a good prince, but he wanted to be.
Evan Thomas. It's a book called Being Nixon, A Man Divided. Evan, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
We've got a couple of podcasts to tell you about in case you missed stuff on the radio. First of all, an extended version of the interviews we do for Conversations from the Corner Office. It is, as you know, CEOs in their own words at full length on a podcast that is called, cleverly, Corner Office. Also, a new partnership with Quartz, a podcast called Actuality, hosted by our own Sabri Benishore and Tim Fernholz from Quartz. It is the stories behind the news. This final note on the way out today, which features an audio quiz. Here you go. Identify this sound. I hope it works on the radio. Here it is. If you guessed bubble wrap, go to the head of the class. And now take a moment to mourn that simplest of childhood pleasures, popping bubble wrap. The Wall Street Journal reports there is a new version set to hit the market. It is called, for some completely indecipherable reason, iBubble Wrap. And sadly, it will not do this. Dow Industrials gave back 27 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ off 3 points. That is less than a 10%. The S&P 500 off a fraction of a point, pretty much even at 2076. Remember, Wall Street is closed, stocks, bonds, the whole smash. Which means I can say now the Dow and the S&P both off 1.2%. The NASDAQ down 1.4%. Golda Arthur, Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Sean, Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We, however, even though Wall Street is off, we'll be here. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.